Welcome, listeners. My name is James McLean. I have alongside me, figuratively speaking, John Kenneth Muir. Unless it's not figuratively, and he's about to walk into my room from behind, and this is all one glorious setup akin to those sort of 1970s shows when they would have people pop in. Well, I'm thinking of This Is Your Life, the British one. Are you aware of that one,
John? Yes. Yes, although for a minute I was thinking you were thinking of Alan Funt and Candid Camera.
Well, yes, absolutely. Yeah, of course, Candid Camera. So, yeah, nice one. You batted it back across the pond. Nice.
That's right.
Transatlantic. Yeah, cool. So, yeah, as you can tell, my name is James McLean. I am constantly distracted and easily going off on weird tangents. I say weird, not in like cool weird, just in the sense that I should be perhaps being a little more normal as a host and taking you down the path rather than pulling you into the bushes, up the trees and down the streams and wherever I've decided to go. I think at the moment we're standing in a puddle. This is an ongoing set of podcasts. We did some back in like 2017, 2018, which I think will be listed along with this one. We stopped because one, I lost a recording we did, which was really good. And by the time I realized it, I was utterly ashamed and just went very quiet for a bit because I felt utterly unprofessional. And in part because we had the pandemic, which just kind of threw everyone's lives into, I'm sure you all know what we mean by that. So we're back now. We're all a little more stable. We're all in a better place, maybe. The world might not be. I'm not quite sure. But we are here. So, like I said, that was the most off the beaten track introduction I think I've probably done in a long time. John, how are you doing?
I am doing well, and I like the idea of going up a tree and down the stream. So I think that should be our guiding principle, James. So.
Well, isn't that the way? I mean, if you're in a video game, if you're in a world, you know, you see the path you're meant to take. You don't want to take it. You want to go into the house, don't you, next door, and you're trying to see if there's any actual viable entrances to that building, and often there isn't because it's just a prop. Or, you know, you want to, yeah, you don't ever really want to go down the path you're meant to be on.
Right. That is so true. That is so true. And you should never be ashamed. I love doing these with you. And, you know, the onus is always on you because you're always recording. So, you know, no apologies, no recriminations. Don't worry about that.
Well, I mean, I will say, actually, before we start, one of the reasons I decided to sort of hit you up and get talking to you again was you did a podcast for Fourth Horseman Press on the Millennium Back to Frank Black book that came out many years ago. And I was listening to that omnibus with you talking to the lovely Adam Chamberlain. And I was just like, yes, it'd be really nice to talk to John again. I miss John.
I miss you too.
I think everyone misses John. So today we thought we would have a talk about sort of like what we'd probably call transmedia, sort of thinking about audio as a medium of narrative and story, and sort of where that goes or where what can go to it. And just kind of that whole sort of space. And up front, this kind of links into a little bit of what you've been doing recently, John, which is kind of what sort of spurred this idea for a chat. So I think out of all sense of transparency and pure promotional guile, do you want to sort of explain what you've been doing of late?
Yes. Thank you, James. So, you know, it's funny that you mentioned the pandemic, because what I'm doing now really arose out of the pandemic. And it's a long and complex story. But going back 14 years or so, sometime back when I was younger, I had created a web series. Now, this was a web series that had to air on VO, because at the time it was airing, YouTube would not allow videos more than 10 minutes. And the episodes of this show were, you know, 30, 40 minutes long. So this was a web series called The House Between, that ran for 3 years and I think 21 episodes. You know, obviously super low budget because I'm not made of money, you know, completely independent. We had some great success. We were nominated for some web awards for our second and third season. And then, you know, it was just sort of hard to keep doing that. And, you know, lo and behold, in the pandemic, one of the stars of the show, her name is Alicia. She plays Teresa. She said to me, you know, if you ever wanted to re-edit that, this would be the time, because one, The House Between was about a bunch of people trapped in a house and they couldn't get out. Science fiction, all like the reasons why, you know, and we were all trapped in our houses. She's like, you know, this is a great time, you know? So I spent a lot of the pandemic, my free time re-editing that old series and getting it, you know, getting it posted to YouTube finally. And that created some openings with, you know, former producers and cast members and things like that. And so we, like everybody who was involved in the show was watching it on YouTube. And, you know, we got together for a Zoom reunion during the pandemic. And they said, you know, we should really do this again. And I said, oh, wait a minute, though, I'm old, right? We've all aged 14 years, you know? And so it was actually, I think it was our lighting guru from the show, Kevin Flanagan, who is now a film scholar, and I think he's a university instructor at George Mason. He said, you know, you should do it as an audio series. And I kind of brushed it off, and I was like, yeah, I should do it as an audio series, blah, blah, blah. I have no idea what that means or how I would do it. And then, like, over the next couple of weeks, some people started getting to me. One of my producers, I think, mentioned it, and one of the stars of the show, Tony Mercer, was like, you know, this is possible. This is something you can do. Listen to this Big Finish Doctor Who thing. Listen to this. You know, there's a way forward here. And, you know, I come from a very visual background. You know, if people read my blog or my books, you know, I talk a lot about, you know, visual symbolism and things like that. So I was thinking, oh boy, this is just really not going to work at all, because I don't know how to do that. And, you know, I started to listen. My wife, who is producing, like, you know, she began listening to things like to Less Is Morgue and Night Vale, you know, these audio dramas. I listened to more of the Doctor Who from Big Finish. And I was like, oh, okay. It's a totally different medium. But look at this. I mean, like, Big Finish is doing what? Like Sapphire and Steel, Blake Seven, The Prisoner. The Omega Factor, even, how's that for a deep dive, right? Going back to the 70s.
Did you not mention Space 1999 as well?
And you know, Space 1999, absolutely my favorite. You know, I think that was not yet out, I think, when we began right. doing this, and then very quickly came out. And, you know, I'm so glad you mentioned it, James, because I really wondered, how are they going to do this? Because Space 1999, my whole analysis of it in my book was that it, you know, what the problem, why it had such a bad reputation, is that people couldn't read visuals. You weren't, you know, that the show was designed for this visual symbolism. And, you know, that was such a core piece of Space 1999. And then the audio drama comes along, I'm thinking, well, how are you going to do that? You know, but again, it's a completely different animal. So
I'm just interested here because I've learned something new, I think. Did you not really listen to Big Finish before this? Was this kind of a space? Had that been something that just not been of interest to you in terms? Because, I mean, obviously you've written about Doctor Who, as you say, Space 1999, Blake Seven. Right. Was that something you had avoided, or you just hadn't, or you dabbled in? What was the situation there?
Oh, I think, you know, I'm just going to admit it, but I had listened to some years back, and at the time, I very wrongly thought, this is interesting, but it's less than, you know, it's less than, you know, seeing a Doctor Who. It's less than Sapphire Steel. Like, I love the visuals of Sapphire Steel. How are you going to do this? Like it's always going to be less than something like, you know, a visual web series or a visual, you know, a TV show or a movie. I mean, it was a stupid, bad point of view. So, you know, for me, I mean, you know, when I was very young, you know, my first experience with audio drama was National Public Radio did Star Wars, you know, and you're talking about, you know, Brock Peters as Darth Vader. And I think it was, who was, Perry King was Han Solo, right? You know, and I, like, I remember, I was like, I mean, I couldn't have been but 8 or 9 years old. I remember like sitting on my parents' bed and they were sitting on the bed and we were, it was like a, it was on Sundays. And, you know, we would listen to, you know, the serialized installment of Star Wars. And I did really love that. So like, I did have somewhere way back where I liked that. And then, you know, I had, you know, a War of the Worlds record. It was like a rock opera version of War of the Worlds. So, you know, I did have some of that in my background, but, you know, by and large, I would say the appeal and value of the format was not really understood by me in a really very deep way until it was kind of pointed out to me. And that's where, you know, again, Tony Mercer, who is our sound designer on the show and on it, and it's called Enter the House Between, he really had to sort of walk me to it and, you know, guide me to it and say, listen. And he had, and he even had to tell me how to listen. He had to say, you know, put on your headphones. Don't just listen to this on the computer. You know, you need headphones and you need to listen to what's actually happening. And it, you're not just listening for dialogue and things like that. So for me, it was, you know, something that I had in my, you know, absolute ignorance, really kind of dismissed as less than. And so I wasn't particularly enthusiastic about the idea of doing this. Except that I wanted to tell more stories in this universe, in the House Between. And, you know, suddenly, you know, my wife is telling me how amazing things like Night Vale are. You know, I'm listening to Doctor Who. My other producer, Joe Madry, he's helping me write the scripts. And he's saying, you know, he's basically saying, you know, I need to have my eye on my ear when I'm writing these. It's like, you know, you need to write these in a certain way so that, you know, you're doing, creating setting and things like that by the choices you make and what we hear. And so it was like learning a new language. And it just, you know, it took me maybe 2 or 3 scripts before I realized like how exciting and amazing and you know, what the potentials are of this format. Because, you know, when we made The House Between, and it is on YouTube, but I'm not necessarily encouraging anybody to go back and watch the original episode. You know, they were made for $500 an episode. You know, it was a bunch of enthusiastic people. The cast is great. Stories are great, but the, you know, it looks very cheap. You know, we were limited, you know, I was limited in what we could do then because, you know, I'm, like I said, I'm not independently wealthy. I was an independent filmmaker trying to create this web series on the cheap, you know, and then suddenly I'm in a world with an audio drama, a full cast audio drama, where I can go anywhere and do anything and take the characters, you know, into any kind of situation. And, you know, as soon as I got past sort of my own, I don't want to use the word prejudice. I don't know if it's more correct to say prejudice or ignorance, but as soon as I got past that and realized, you know, what this format offered, I thought, oh my gosh, this is like so much better. You know, this is, it's so much better to be able to operate in this format. And there are so many possibilities here. And, you know, I just wasn't tuned to that. I didn't have, you know, a sustained history of listening to Big Finish or anything like that until literally I was guided there by, you know, Tony Mercer. So I don't know if that answers the question, but yeah, that was not part of my sort of normal world. I've always been such a visual, you know, been so focused on the visual, I guess you'd say.
What sort of elements do you find particularly exciting? If you've got any examples, and perhaps what do you actually find is limiting, or are there things you have to be aware of?
Well, that's a really interesting question, because the way we produce these, and I know obviously when you sort of have more money and have a studio, this is the way you create them. And, you know, to all those independent, you know, audio drama makers out there, my hat is off to you, you know, and often what they will do is like, you'll simply like cast somebody, like that you'll audition them and they're sort of in the room recording their lines alone. You know, what we do, and, you know, we don't have a studio, but we all kind of, we all get on Zoom together and record our scenes together so that we sort of have that chemistry and have what people are reacting to. So it's like we're all on our own mics and we're recording only our mics, but we're listening to each other. It creates, you know, there are all kinds of technical difficulties with that because, you know, we're reacting to each other, but there's Zoom lag. There are things like that. But I think the benefit of it that way, and when we started to create Enter the House Between, I said, look, there's no way I want to do this if I'm just going to sit alone in a room and, record lines and that's what everyone's going to do. And then we're going to like cut them together. Like that holds no appeal for me, but if we're all going to get together and play and go through the scripts where, we can ad lib and play off what the other person gives us. I said that I am interested in. So, that was one thing we had to sort of settle right at the start, which is that, I didn't want it to be this kind of thing where it's like you're in isolation acting your part and then someone else is in isolation mm-hmm. acting their part. Yeah. And then it's up to the designer and editor to make it sound like it all happened together. Because I do think that, even though I've never had a lot of money, I think I'm very good at casting. Right? And I really think the actors in this, they were great, on the old show, given the limitations of what they had to deal with. But they're even better, I feel, in this audio format. But I like the magic of it to me is being able to play off each other. And I'm sure that's what they do at Big Finish. I'm sure they're all in some glorious studio together and, doing that whenever they can. But I know that's not always an option for people. So that can be a limitation for sure. And then you get into all these technical things because, we have a cast of maybe 8 or 9 regulars. And so we're all supposed to be recording on our computer. And it's like, we get through a scene, it's wonderful. Someone says, oh my God, I forgot to press record. And it's like, oh no.
Don't know what that's like.
right. It's like, oh, I didn't record that one. We always lay out the scene once, we do it another time and we do it like a play take, and sometimes before we start, I or somebody else who's in the scene, so like, let me ad lib a little bit on this one and see where we end up or whatever. But so that's been one thing. We all laugh doing Enter the House Between now because we all have these dark sound booths in our house to keep sound out, and that's where we record from. But when we were doing the web series, we were in an old house here in North Carolina, and we like blacked out all the windows because you were supposed to be like the house was outside of time and space, that kind of thing. There was a null zone of blackness around the house. So we had, black curtains up over every window in the house. So you'd go in, you'd be sort of submerged in this world for, 16, 17 hours while we shot. But now it's like the same thing because we're going into except we're all in our little individual, black booths doing the same thing. So it's like the more things have changed, the more they've really stayed the same for us in a sense. But I think it would be very hard and very limiting if I knew that, we weren't going to be able to play off each other. I know because I see the ads on Facebook and things like that say, hey, I need this part in a web series, in an audio drama, somebody to do this part this age, send in your audition tape and then you will have you record your lines. And to me that's just a very difficult way. That would be a very difficult way to do this. And I'm glad we don't have to do that, but that means scheduling is difficult at times. And then our editor is left with, 9 different tracks, which he needs to put together into an assembly cut, I'm glad I'm not the editor on this bit, that's sort of Tony's game. But one of the things I really like about it is that, the old show, the premise of it was that, these people were trapped in a house. It was called a smart house, right? And it was controlled by AI called Lars. And these Lars could basically, by accessing what we call the quantum sphere, but which now everybody calls the multiverse, sort of open up doorways to different realities, right? Different times, different realities, things like that. And you know, because we were shooting in real life in an old house, like they were in a malfunctioning house that never worked right. It could never really take any form. You know, it would be like, oh, the house isn't working, right? You know, it's not, you know, we would do a little bit of that. But, it was, you know, it's hard to create those things. I couldn't create a ship at sea. You know, I couldn't create, you know, all these things, you know, on my budget. Now it's like, wow, we've realized the form. It's like now that smart house works great in audio, if you get what I'm saying. But yeah, you know, with sound effects and things like that, we can do all the, we can sort of realize the potential of the story, which is a real virtue of this format that we could not. And so for Doctor Who, like for instance, look, these beloved actors who we want to keep doing Doctor Who, right? But they can't necessarily, you know, they're not necessarily going to go on screen, you know, that are in their 80s, whatever. But gosh, we can have them, their voices are still strong. We can have them right back in audio format. So that, like, that's a virtue too, right? That you can bring back people who may not want to work six or be capable of working 16-hour days, you know, and a studio might not want to foot the bill for that. It's like, oh, let's do a fourth Doctor adventure, you know, and he's 80, what is he, 89 years old?
How do you deal with probably one of the hardest bits of audio storytelling narrative? And that is, as you say, because it is literally a visually limited space, a way of communicating to the audience elements which aren't visible to the audience, but need to be naturally dropped in without it sounding unnatural. How do you handle those sort of elements? Because those can obviously be quite big flags, which can obviously can break an immersion of a listener sometimes, but also the listener's usually kind of aware that they've got to be there because there's only certain ways that you can do this.
Right.
What's your take and how do you handle those moments where you can't navigate around the visual medium where you would like to?
So this is funny because there's a line from, okay, I love A Nightmare on Elm Street 3, Dream Warriors, right? I love all those Nightmare on Elm Street movies, but that movie in particular, there's a moment where Heather Langenkamp, and you can see her, I mean, this is a movie, a door appears in front of her and she says, it's a door. And like, it's like my wife and I laugh whenever we watch it because it's obvious it's a door, right? A door is floating in front of her and she says, it's a door. Like, why wasn't that cut by the editor? It's not her fault, but it's like, it's clear she's standing in front of a door. A door appears before her, kind of levitating into Freddy's domain. And she says, it's a door. Well, we all know it's a door. You know, the thing with audio drama is that line is completely valid. Mm. And you need to often say that, like, say things like, you know, hurry up. What, you know, what are you looking at over there? You know, it's a door. I mean, you do have to, and you know, it seems kind of dumb, right? But it's like, you listen to it and it's not dumb. You have to have the characters, that's one way, sort of guide you to what's happening, right? Another, and Tony, again, I just want to bring him up, Tony Mercer, he's the, you know, the engineer, the designer for the show, you know, he's very good about like having motifs for each episode and for characters so that even if consciously, you know, sound motifs, whether it's music or what have you, that, you know, will call you back into like knowing what's happening. There's one episode we did, it's called Shelling Point, and there's a character who's sort of being very manipulative to another character, and there's this sort of piano theme, and every time like we're back to those two characters, that piano theme reasserts. And so, you know, if you listen closely, you begin to see like how it fits together, and you know, you process that while you listen. But I mean, it's also the art of finding or creating the right sound effects, you know, having a clock or, you know, things like that. You know, you have to sort of be very aware of like what's in the environment, you know, in some ways, much more so than when you're directing a visual episode. You know, it's like, yeah, there can be a clock back there, but it's not that important that a clock is in the frame, right? But here, if you, you know, you can create a mood by having a clock ticking and some ominous music. So now suddenly everybody is like on edge, right? Because they hear that clock ticking and I think there's something involved with time going on, and listen to that ominous music. So, you know, Tony, you know, is a real master, I think, of doing that. And, it's so important, but you have to be sort of conscious of where your characters are. You have to have them comment on that, even though that can seem dumb. Like, you know, it would seem dumb in a movie to say that it's a door, but you know, if you have a sound effect of a portal opening, like, oh my God, that portal is opening. You say, that's not a portal. That's a breach. Watch out. You know, and you sort of have to narrate almost more in your dialogue to really create that scene. And some of the things he's done have just been amazing to me. We have a scene who is like often in a barn loft, and it, you know, the loft is obviously up high and there's a ladder down to the barn floor. And sometimes someone will be calling up to the person, and it's like, you can hear the different positions. And I'll be honest, I don't know how he does it. Like, you can hear like that somebody sounds closer to the mic and that somebody sounds further. You know, Tony could tell you how to do that. I don't know how he does it, but like, I'm always so impressed. Like, oh my gosh, I can like hear where they are in position to each other. And, you know, you very quickly become tuned to that. And I like that. I mean, it's its own genre of writing, performing, editing, for sure.
I think it's one of those things where, because the visual medium has had so much exposure, and obviously because it carries, we can't deny it, it carries an extra layer of sense there. But even there are cues. And I think it was interesting when you're talking about the music motifs, because if you think of things like in visual television, I was thinking, going back to Blake Seven, whenever there would be a move back to the Liberator, usually an establishing shot, you'd have a very specific musical cue that they would only ever do for the Liberator. And then obviously you'd have the ambience inside, and the sounds would also, if you were then to move it onto audio, that would give you the cues as well. But it's interesting where we have cues. And I think music alone is one of those fascinating things, one of those sort of leftovers from the days of the sort of silent cinema, which carried on through into the talkies, and Marinette managed somehow to become, you know, entrenched in how we watch drama, certainly in the West. And yet we never really sort of get frustrated with the fact, well, some people do, that, you know, that there is an orchestra playing alongside a scene out in a yard. You know, we have these sort of weird sort of cues which cue into our ability to understand a scene. And obviously, as you know, that, you know, incidental music is there to sort of heighten certain emotive experiences, so it's there to sort of help guide the audience as much as as you say, the scripted cues. And we accept that in the visual medium and say, oh, that's fine, you know, but it's real because it's visual. And it's like, well, you know, it's not, it's still a construct. And as you say, that audio space is a different construct, and yes, it also has, quite often has, music as well. So I'm not saying it's different in that sense, but thinking about the cues and, like you say, how different these spaces are and how they work, I think is a was really interesting. And also, like, you know, that old line, you know, from the song, you know, video killed the radio star back in the 80s. And you see now where in the last 10 years, especially, massive resurgence in sort of radio and audio.
Yes.
From millennials and Gen Z, but primarily millennials, which, for those who don't know, we're kind of talking about people born sort of within the 80s up until the 2000s, before the cusp of the 2000s, who are very much into audio podcasts, and podcasts meaning as something like this, but it could also mean a narrative podcast, as you mentioned earlier.
Right. And I think there are a number of, you know, different answers to that. And I don't know that I have the answer, but, you know, some of the things I think about, you know, in regards to that is that, you know, it's almost counterintuitive, but you think about, I remember when I was writing my Sam Raimi book, you know, he was obsessed with, in Evil Dead and, you know, so many of his films in the 80s and 90s, with the idea of special effects as magic tricks. These are things you're pulling off in front of the camera. These are actually physical things we're doing, right? That you're going to see, that, you know, the gags in Evil Dead, something like that. They're magic tricks, according to Raimi. And the joy of those is that you're watching somebody do something that is tangible in front of you. You know, you think about the practical effects of The Thing or Evil Dead, right? Like, somebody has constructed this and it's this magical thing, but it's actually happening in front of you. Now think about going from the 1990s to the present, how special effects have become mostly computer generated. And there's no doubt they look better now than they did in 1995, but it's not the idea of like somebody like, you know, constructed this thing and there are gears that are making it happen. You know, it's not, the magic trickness of it is kind of gone. Now it's like, oh, there's a program and, you know, it's all paint. You know, we all do it with all these, you know, Ant-Man because... and Quantumania. There's something less literally very magical about it.
It's the magic trick. The magic trick has to play on the lines that there is a risk factor, that right. there could be an exposure to the person doing it, that they could see through the magic trick. So the magic trick exists in a sense that the audience, be it with a magician or with a special effect film, could see through how you've done that. And that becomes sort of almost like the engagement and perhaps even the reality for the audience watching. It's why it kind of feels real, because it is real, but they also yes. know they're in an uncanny valley where they might just slip and see how it's done. But as soon right. as you get, as you say, I think the first film I saw where I kind of felt like, yeah, I give up, was probably actually, X-Files: Fire the Future. And it wasn't a special effect trick. It was just one of their wide shots, which I think near the end, which was largely computer generated just to expand. It might have been the crash source or wherever it was at the end. And I was like, yeah, there's no way I could have known that, really. It's kind of hard. And I think you can still see audiences quite keen to tear apart shows which the CGI isn't as good, because that's the nearest as they can get to the magic trick that they can say, right. I can see that CGI, it's not real, so therefore I've seen your magic trick. But at the same time, they still don't actually know, unless they're in the field particularly, the ingenuity isn't there to some degree, or where it is, it's not as obvious to the audience. I think there's right. a bit of that there. You see, because it's a process in itself, it's a very under the bonnet process.
It's, right, and it's... If you think about John Carpenter's The Thing, right, we never really saw it in its original form. We never saw like what size it could be, but we saw all these pieces of it. And the pieces of it, like you said, there was that danger to them. It's like, you know, what are we going to see? Are we going to see a wire? Are we, you know, are we going to see the puppet or whoever, you know, the guy moving the puppet, the puppeteer, right? Whoever is, you know, pulling this gear to make this tentacle do this thing, you know, and it just, there is that danger to that, right? There's that danger, that idea we might see what it is. But like, also the other thing that happens in that movie is our imagination kicks in, and our imagination kicks in and we think, wow, look at this, what we're seeing, this arm come up out of a dog, right? And look, what is that, what are the characteristics of that arm, and what do they look like, where did that come from, you know, what part of the thing is that? And so there was this thing where it's like we're sort of imagining what the whole thing is, or what the thing could have been, or what planets it could have gone to. You know, with CGI we would just get a flashback and we'd see, you know, this huge thing going to another planet absorbing. And yeah,
so I was just thinking, but is that also because when you have a hand coming out a dog and you know it's not CGI, you probably, there's an intuitive part of you knows that unless the next scene proves differently, that's it. There's nothing beyond that hand, right, that piece. Right. So you're kind of led to think, you know, what could the rest of it be like? Well, with CG, yes. you yes. know that whole thing could be built. There's no sort of limit there. There's no sort of throttle.
This ties into the audio, because the audio is asking us to imagine everything. What do the characters look like? How old are they? You know, in our first story, which is called The Oneness Intended for Us All, there's this thing called Legion. It's a sort of weaponized drone that's almost like an insect that can like go around and like quantum decohere people, and it's like a swarm of locusts, right? And you don't see it, but the way it's presented, and at some point it's attacking our protagonists in the story, it's like it becomes so compelling. And you know, anybody who maybe 70, you know, my dad's age, 79, who listened to radio growing up, it's like, you guys are idiots. This was why we loved radio in the, you know, 1930s and 40s. But that idea of imagination being a crucial component, and then we're having to conjure so much, you know, and the excitement of that, you know, the idea of that, you know, somebody is creating art where they're telling a story, but we have to fill in so many gaps that we fill it in with ourselves, and it becomes very immediate and very immersive, and it exercises our imagination
and very intimate as well.
Yeah,
it becomes an intimate experience because it is unique to what you are seeing in that space. Right. So it's it becomes a very personalized medium.
Right. So, one of our characters is named Astrid. And, I imagine anybody listening to it would have like different impressions of what Astrid looks like based on, the performer's voice. But, and I can't say one is right, except, it looks like this person. I can show the picture of her. And I've shown her in the booth. But you know what I'm saying? It's like you can create, they can be anybody. They can be anime styled characters. They can be in their 20s. They can be in their 30s. They can be in their 40s. They can be of different ethnic backgrounds. It's like, I want the people to paint in. I want the audience to paint in all of that themselves, because it does make it more intimate. It makes the experience more intimate and sort of geared to each individual, which is a funny thing to say in mass entertainment. But, one of the things I think we've seen in the last 30 years is this switch where, films have become very homogenized because they have to win that opening weekend, right? So, they're very generic. They don't tell stories that are particularly deep. The characters are more like archetypes than they are like people. We've got Thor, we've got Ant-Man, it's designed as this mass thing that everybody can maybe find something they identify, a universal thing. And I think what's interesting about audio is it gives us that opportunity, as I said, to fill in the gaps of what we don't see with ourselves. And how you fill in that gap is going to be different than how I fill in that gap. One of the things that's been most exciting and very different for me about doing Enter the House Between as opposed to the original web series is that then, we would shoot it, record it. I knew what everybody looked like. I edited the show and I put it out. At this point, I write, I direct episodes, I perform in some of them. I'm a character there. But then I hand it over to Tony, and I really have no idea what it's going to be like until he sends it back to me and I listen to it. And, I'm just floored sort of by his imagination and sort of what these words on the page and these voices, become in these settings that he's created from whole cloth, sometimes finding things that that wasn't specifically written in the story, but maybe was suggested by his imagination. It's just really amazing. So I've become this sort of full throttle proponent of this format when all my, my training, when I did film and all that, was very different from this, right?
Because it's interesting, because obviously some of the ones that we've mentioned in this podcast so far, Doctor Who Big Finish kicked off in a wide hiatus, a wasteland of when Doctor Who was no longer running, and became a source of entertainment for those who were missing the show. I'm sure you're aware of Robin of Sherwood.
Are you? Right. Oh yes, absolutely.
But they pre-COVID again, they did an audio drama with pretty much the living cast, which took one of the writer's last scripts, I believe, which was intended to actually finish off the series. This was a series on ITV in the UK, right, which went in the early 80s, starring Michael Praed and later on Jason Connery, Sean Connery's son, and a whole host of kind of famous people as well who have popped up ever since. But yeah, and it was used, the audio drama, they did a Kickstarter and they got the money together and they did this final episode with the cast in 2014, 2015. And then I think they did some subsequent ones and they got Michael Praed to come back as well. And yeah, it became a way of sort of bringing a bookend to a series which didn't manage to get a bookend. And it's just interesting that we don't really, it's not a medium where that happens. Even given, as you say, that it's very cheap to run in terms of talent. Yes, talent can still be expensive, but I'm presuming it would be certainly less expensive than having them on a set for, several months when you could get them to audio record over several weeks. Right. If you own the IP, that's not an issue. You're just outsourcing to a company which can produce audio. It's interesting that we just don't see any sort of tie-ups through audio, not particularly, given how many cancellations, even in this day and age, are happening.
Well, you know, if Jane Badler is out there and listening, I would love to see a conclusion to her V, you know, done in audio, to V the series, or, you know, or,
yeah.
I mean, you know, certainly we are, I think there's been talk recently. I think they're looking at doing, you know, SETI Alpha 5, like a prequel to The Wrath of Khan, you know, Khan, you know, on the planet, you know, maybe doing that as an audio adventure. But, you know, I guess I'm Mr. Canceled, you know, sci-fi, because I love these things. And like you, I long for another chapter. Like, why not Millennium? Why not a Frank Black audio adventure, right? Why not? Lance Henriksen has, as you know, I mean, a fantastic voice, that gravelly. I mean, you can't mistake his voice for anyone's voice. I remember when I saw the remake of When a Stranger Calls, I'm not very good, but he was doing the calls. Like, whoa, you know, I jumped out of my chair. Like, Lance Henriksen is the caller, you know, in that movie. It's like, wow. So why not a Millennium audio drama? Why, you know, so, okay. So maybe the, you know, whatever the issues are about, you know, creating a movie or a TV series, a TV reunion, I think the cost of doing that would probably be negligible compared to those things, right?
But obviously part of the reason is, going back to, say, John Kenneth Muir a few years ago, is that there is a prejudice against the medium, isn't
yeah.
there? I mean, a few years ago when a Doctor Who spin-off Torchwood announced that they were coming back, and the disappointment was, you know, palpable in responses to those posts, and they realized it was an audio drama.
Yeah, you could not be more right, James. And, you know, even as I'm saying this, I'm thinking about Millennium. And Millennium, what is the symbol? The yellow house. What is that? A visual, right? You're talking about his gift, being able to see inside the mind of the killer, right? Think about those flash. Okay, so there are going to be things you lose. That is so true. But, like, what you gain? You know, what do we gain? Well, we could gain a Frank Black circa 2001. Right. You know, just by hearing his voice, because, you know, obviously anybody, you know, Lance Henriksen, may we age. Right. so you could suddenly get a 50-year-old, you know, we could follow him through decades. Right. Which, you know, unless you're going to do expensive de-aging CGI, you know, in a project like that, you can't do visually. But again, we could have him sort of at the height of Frank Black's journey again, continuing that story. And with an adept writer, as I'm sure they would have, you learn how to do symbolism differently. You do it through the sound motifs. You do it through things like that. And, you know, that just becomes, you know, the new mode of the series. And I think you'd be surprised how soon people would come to it if they could get over, like what I said, I had, as you said, the ignorance or the prejudice about that format. I mean, you know, so many people, you know, you ask me, like, why is this popular now? Well, I think because people hate commutes. You can listen to these while you're commuting. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of us have, not me, I mean, teaching, I obviously can't be having headphones on listening, but, you know, many people have jobs that require them to do sort of rote activities that don't require sort of 100% of their attention. They put up, you know, they can do the job and they can listen to the stories, right? You know, I mean, I think that's also, I mean, the audio drama world catalog out there, I mean, it's as timeless as space, it's as vast as space and as timeless as infinity. I mean, promoting Enter the House Between is harder than producing it, because there are so many great shows out there, so many different people vying for your attention. You know, you got all the great Big Finish, the BBC stuff too. You've got things like Night Vale. You know, you've got Independence. You've got now, you know, maybe Paramount is going to get into it. You know, NPR did stuff. It's like, oh wow, okay. So it's like, it's all out there, but there are a lot of people who are not going to get past their ignorance and say, let me test this out. Again, I had people guide me and kind of lead me by the hand. You know, my wife, you know, Sam, John, you should do this because listen to this. This is so good. Listen to what they're doing. Tony saying, you know, listen, you know, pay attention. Here's this. He paid for me to listen to a Doctor Who. You know, he got me a subscription so I could hear the Doctor Who thing. You know, the big finish, one of the big finished ones. You know, so it's not easy because I do think, you know, some people are going to be tuned to this idea of these things as radio, and some people are going to really object to it, and not want to lose that visual component. Or, I mean, let's face it, we are not used to right now. It's not part of our skill set to be doing all that imagining. Right. You know, I do sometimes think, and this is like the old person, and I'm so sorry to be that cantankerous old guy who says this, but like if when I think back to Doctor Who or Blake Seven or the original Star Trek, all of which I love so much, you know, you go back and it's like, you know, the monsters are dodgy, the special effects are dodgy, but there was something, right? And we imagined it. We imagined it into a reality. You know, again, the limits of those things were made up for by, you know, the intelligence and the attention to detail and the imagination of those stories, even if the execution couldn't always carry it through, right? So maybe for somebody my age, it's like, yeah, it was like coming back to that idea. But, you know, I don't know, the newer generations, for instance, maybe they do, maybe they're longing for this, and that's why they're going to that.
But then it is these younger generations who are the audio market, which is the interesting thing. So they are the ones who are who have tapped into this. And I think, as you said earlier, I think for those reasons, as you said, saturation of content can sometimes mean on TV that people just sort of step back from that. I think, as you say, for commuting, I think, as you say, for multitasking, not just at work, but I think I know people who, while they're doing their crafts, who enjoy, you know, a lot of millennials enjoy, you know, physical crafts, which as a late Gen X, I kind of never imagined would be the case. I thought the future generations would be there on their, you know, hyper data pads, but they're not. They're, a lot of them have, you know, got very physical possessions. They enjoy that tactileness, and that's and a tactileness can be an oral sensation as well. There is certainly a sort of sterilization to the sort of imagination in terms of television and film, but that we didn't have growing up, where you had to join the dots. But I think there's almost like a reversal in the sense that it's sort of younger generations which perhaps are being a little more open to change. Can't also make that too much of a big thing, because as you said, you know, Big Finish, our generation, there was a lot of radio listened in our generation, and also started, you know, as I say, late 2000s, early 1990s, sorry, with Big Finish.
Well, and I think there's, you know, what happened with YouTube and what I sort of wished maybe would happen. And I think it's happening. It's just not necessarily happening in science fiction. You know, when I created the web series, The House Between, and put it on VO all those years ago, I thought, this is great. Like, I can now distribute this. People can find it. Fans are going to, who, you know, they're going to start making their own things, their own universes. They'll no longer be tethered to some copyrighted thing. They're going to create their own thing, because now they have the means not only to create it cheaply, but they have the distribution. That was the last piece that, you know, I can't afford to distribute some of the theaters, but I can put it up on YouTube. But, you know, what I saw and what disappointed me at the time in like 2006 or so was that, what was I seeing fans all do? We're going to do, you know, our own Star Trek movies. Yeah. We're going to do our own Star Wars fan. It's like, oh, no one was creating something new. But what I've discovered totally accidentally by, you know, dipping my toe into this vast world of, you know, full cast audio dramas is there are so many original visions out there in that format. Mm-hmm. So like what I imagined was going to happen, you know, in 2006 with, you know, with video has actually, I think, happened with audio and these, you know, the, you know, podcast, whatever you want to call them, full cast audio dramas, that, you know, people are creating their visions there. And as always, some are going to be great, some not so great. But I have to imagine, you know, I think that because I'm someone, let's say, in my early to mid 50s, you know, if you look at it, Star Wars has been around since I was Seven, Star Trek since before I was born. These are things that I love, but they're these monolithic things that have existed a long time now. Yeah. And so now imagine that you are Generation Z like my son, and you come along, and it's like, so do you tie into your dad's entertainment? Like, is Star Wars or even MCU, is it really, is it speaking to them, or is it an artifact of something older? And by going to out and finding Night Vale or Less is More or whatever, or even the Big Finish things that are, my doctor is Paul McGann and he didn't get his own TV show. Right. You can do that. Right. You know, suddenly like there are these niches for people to fall into where our culture, the way movies are being so monolithic, it's like, oh my God, you got to have the brand name. You know, we got to do the next Star Wars movie. We got to do the next MCU. We got to do the next DC movie. I mean, I feel kind of sorry for James Gunn, because it's like, man, I would not want to be entering the superhero today, because I think people are burned out. It's like, oh my God, how many versions of that? You know, that's not to say Superman will never come back in or Batman won't have a certain threshold, but it's like, you know, God, give it a rest, you know. And I think these audio dramas are showing that we can tell stories outside of that mold. We can tell stories outside of this sort of blockbuster mold, and that people are sort of longing for that. Again, some you might turn on one and not like it. I mean, I love Enter the House Between. I hope everybody loved it, but you know, maybe it's not for everybody, you know, and those people won't tune in, but we'll find some audience who is interested in it. And you know, it doesn't have to be, you know, the size of Star Wars audience to be successful, because the stakes are lower in terms of cost and things. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I think it does. I think we will probably return to audio in another cast, because I think there's a lot more that could be said about this, and also that sort of movement as well, because we haven't really touched upon, you know, moving from audio to television, which, or audio to another media, which has happened quite a few times. And again, that has interesting connotations, with obviously Douglas Adams' Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy being the most famous, but there are others. But yeah, so I think we will probably wrap this up. Where should people go if they are intrigued by anything you've said here?
So selfishly, right? Well, okay, so I want to say this. There are some fantastic sort of sites that like roster or tell you like what shows are out there. So you, like if you went to like FeedSpot or Audio Drama Co. UK, Good Pods, you know, you have users there and creators like collating, that's the word, curating is a better word, curating lists, things like that. So, you know, if you're interested, you know, do a Google search on audio drama, you know, go to Spotify or Audible, and, you know, you can type in like, I mean, because there are old radio shows out there, like ones that were produced in the 30s and 40s that you can listen to. There are ones for different genres, science fiction, horror, fantasy, you know, really, you know, whatever you're interested in, you can find. You know, for any listeners who are interested in Enter the House Between, you know, we're on Spotify and Audible. Our website is housebetween.com. We're also on YouTube, you know, if you look for Enter the House Between. But, you know, outside, you know, the series I work on, you know, there's just this whole world of possibilities out there. I'll say this, understand they're not all created equal, you know, different budgets, different sensibilities. You know, it's a matter of finding one really that like kind of fits the vibe you're looking for. So, you know, don't give up, because maybe you find one and it's like not the vibe you want, because there might be another one that does find it. So, you know, there's all, you know, if you Google audio dramas or Audio Drama Co. UK or Good Pods or FeedSpot or anything like that, like they curate lists for you. You know, like there's a list of like the top 100 sci-fi audio dramas there, for instance, you know, and I think Night Vale is well up towards the top, you know, but you could just go down that list, you know, and you have endless entertainment in front of you.
Absolutely. And I think it's particularly sweet how you left your own promotion to the back end of that list and decided to sort of give the broad sweep first. But yes,
I don't want to be too craven. We'll
come back to this, certainly, because there's things I'm very interested in again, this audio realm. And I'm thinking of sort of the big things like Critical Role is another big shift in terms of role-playing and moving into different intervisual mediums. So there's loads of things to talk about this, I'm sure we'll get back to, but for now, if I can ask you all to just go away and come back and see us another day.